Right, the case is submitted. We'll hear argument next, number 88-1000, New York versus Bernard Harris. Mr. Coddington.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Your Honor, I know you're all aware of the facts in this case, so I'm not going to dwell on them. Rather, we believe the New York Court of Appeals erred on four fronts in this case, and if I may, I'd like to concentrate on our first two arguments primarily while I'm at this podium. We believe that the New York Court of Appeals misunderstood Brown and his progeny by holding that a precinct confession, totally voluntary, given outside of a man's house, should be suppressed because the police arrested him in his home without a warrant. Now, I believe they misapplied Brown. Brown merely holds that Miranda's will not attenuate a Fourth Amendment violation in every case. The opinion says so, that Miranda warnings by themselves will not always attenuate. However, Brown also did not adopt any but-for standard. But for a Fourth Amendment violation, confession shall be suppressed. Brown, Taylor, and Dunaway, the three cases on which the Court of Appeals relied, hold merely that when the confession is the product of prolonged involuntary detention without probable cause, then a confession should be suppressed. In those cases, the confession comes as a result of the Fourth Amendment violation. That is, holding a man without probable cause in violation of his Fourth Amendment rights. Where, however, in a case like this, where there is ample probable cause, I submit that the vice that led to the Brown, Dunaway, and Taylor holdings is absent. Once this man was taken outside of his house, the detention was completely lawful for Fourth Amendment purposes. Therefore, the perfectly voluntary confession given later at a public place, the police precinct, I submit should have been admissible. Now,
without regard to any other factors, what I mean is, do you agree with what I think is the Solicitor General's position in his brief that the vice of a going inside the house, in this case to arrest the person, was that you might have seen things inside the house that could be used as evidence, not the mission to arrest him? And
yes,
therefore,
sir.
So long as you're not using any evidence that you saw inside the house to prove your case, the arrest itself is okay.
That's my second point, Chief Justice Rehnquist. We believe also that...
But just on the first point and follow-up to Chief Justice's question, if you assume that the rule is you must exclude the statement that's given in the house, then do you make the same argument here? Or is it just a factual inquiry as to whether or not there's the taint's been attenuated?
Well, I believe we get into attenuation. With respect to the Brown holding, my position is that if there's probable cause, Miranda warnings by themselves should attenuate, and there's no need to go through the threefold factors. Okay? But I also agree that the Peyton rule, I think there should be a bright line rule here, that Peyton applies to evidence that is seized or perhaps observed in the home, and that evidence that is taken outside the home should not be suppressed as a violation of Peyton, if that answers Your Honor's question.
So your first point is that probable cause plus Miranda warnings attenuate without more?
That's right. And my
second point is what?
My second point is that Peyton applies only to evidence seized in the house, and that evidence seized outside the house should not be suppressed under Peyton.
That's the Solicitor General's argument.
Yep.
Go back to your first point a minute. I'm not sure I understood your response to Justice Kennedy. Under your first point, you would say the first confession in this case is also admissible, wouldn't you?
Well, if there's a patent violation, and as you
know... Well, we're assuming there is. I mean, okay. We start with the... At least for purposes of decision, we assume a violation, don't we?
Well, as you know, my fourth point is that the entry was consensual, and if so, there would be no patent violation. Well, but leaving that aside for the moment...
We didn't really need to take
okay. Assuming there's a patent violation, I believe, and we agreed in the state courts, that the confession in the apartment probably should be suppressed.
Why? Under your first argument.
That's right.
Probable cause, and they got Miranda warnings, didn't they?
Well, that's an extension that I was not... Did not make in my brief, however...
No, but it seems to me it's a logical...
I would certainly adopt that here.
Maybe you're right, but I don't know why you differentiate between the first and the second confession.
Because that's the way it was litigated in the state courts, but however, I'm perfectly willing to adopt that position here.
Well, you might consider that confession to be evidence seized in the house.
That was the point I was making. But... Well, I think Wan Sung answers that. Evidence, I believe, of a confession.
Wan Sung.
Well... That's what this all stems from. Actually, in Wong Sun, by the way, the amicus makes the point, Wong Sun is completely different. Wong Sun was released on its own recognizance by a magistrate, which is quite different than the facts of this case. The amicus argued that, against one of our arguments, that perhaps the police should have released this man and then rearrested him. I submit that would have
Inside
been
joke.
Inappropriate. And would not follow under Wong Sun. Back to Justice Stevens' question, I do submit that probable cause plus Miranda's, under normal circumstances, should be enough to render a confession voluntary. And if we can get over the patent violation, then I submit the confession in the apartment actually should have been admissible. However, as I say, that was suppressed by the state court, and we only admitted the precinct confession. The man was convicted with it, so that's not really a question that's before the court.
Did the police have the drawn guns when they went in there?
That's a close question, Your Honor. The testimony was that one officer had a gun in his pocket. One had a gun down by his leg. The defendant was looking through a peephole in the door, so I don't think that he ever saw the guns when he opened the
door. Do you think that was consensual? Do you think that to admit somebody with a gun is consensual?
If he sees the gun, perhaps not. But I don't think there is any evidence that this man saw the guns when he opened the door. And the police testified they holstered their guns as soon as they went. And when he opened the door, you know, they knocked on the door, they said police. I mean, this is not Gulag, this is not Johnson.
Then he could do whatever he wanted to do.
Well, I think he said, I'm glad you're here. Come on in. I mean, I think...
What else do you do with a man with a gun?
Well, I think he can shut the door. That's what I'd do.
You would shut a door with a man with a gun?
Shut the door and duck, yes.
Try it sometime.
No, I think you can do that, Your Honor.
You won't be around to talk about it.
Well, I don't know, Judge. Or Justice.
But I mean, this rule in New York, to me, is not proper under the Constitution. That you don't get a warrant of arrest.
Well, let me touch on that, Your Honor.
There's nothing. There were 5 days.
That's right. Okay, let me...
There's no reason at all except the rule.
Well, under New York law, as Your Honor knows, the police cannot question a defendant without an attorney once they have an arrest warrant. But as I read
What's wrong with that?
Well, I have no quarrel with that either, but there's nothing in any of this court's decisions that says that the Sixth Amendment requires the police to file charges so that the man has an attorney just when they have probable cause.
Well, Mr. Coddington, is it the policy then in New York that arrests are made without warrants to avoid that problem?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's not.
That certainly is the argument made in part by the other side.
Certainly is.
Do you think that's the custom or practice in any agencies in New York?
It may have been the custom of this particular police officer, but as I deal at length in my reply brief, it certainly is not the policy of the New York City Police Department. I mean, I'm not going to say that some police officers don't delay arrest so they can obtain confessions, but I submit that that's perfectly proper. I mean, there's one thing to flagrantly disregard a constitutional right. It's another to tailor your conduct in conformance with the Constitution.
Yes, but to make an arrest without a warrant in a home certainly violates the Constitution, does it not?
If that was their intent when they entered...
I mean, you concede that the arrest without a warrant was unlawful inside the house?
I agree that if it was non-consensual, it violated Peyton, but I submit to Your Honor that, I mean, the record here shows that these police were not...
Do you think Peyton was articulating a constitutional requirement?
I think so, yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I agree.
So you would agree there was a constitutional violation?
Well, understanding Peyton, the police broke in the door when the man wasn't there and searched the apartment. Here, in this case, at page 380 of the record... the detective, Detective Rivers, went to this man's apartment.
Do you think Peyton was determined only because the door was broken in?
Well, there was no warrant, and it was a forceful entry. So far as I know, none of this court's opinions deal with anything like the circumstances of this case. In Welsh v. Wisconsin, they came at late at night. The same was true of Riddick. In Peyton and in Brown, the police broke into the door. Here, there's a knock on the door. Apparently consensual entry.
Well, are you suggesting there's some sort of halfway house between consent to entry and a violation of Peyton?
No, I'm not. I'm just suggesting that on this record, it's a most unclear question.
But the New York Court of Appeals found there was no consent.
That's correct. And that was a factual finding that was binding on them, which I do not believe binds this court, at least not as to the legal conclusion.
No, but we didn't grant certiorari on any question like that, did we?
No. No, I think...
I think you might be well advised to assume that we're very unlikely to relitigate that question.
Okay. So then we will assume a patent violation. Okay. Assuming a patent violation, I believe, again, that... Okay, back to Justice Stevens' question, assuming a patent violation, I believe probably that the confession in the apartment should be suppressed. I submit that the confession at the precinct...
So we don't need to argue anything else.
I was just trying to follow up on Justice Stevens' question. I believe the confession at the precinct should not be suppressed. One, that was taken outside of the house. I believe that Peyton should extend no farther than the house. This is a nice bright-line rule that the court can enact. I think it has an ease of application that will aid police, prosecutor, defense counsel, and state courts in application. I believe, touching back to Justice Marshall's question, that the police behavior here was not designed to violate the Constitution. In Hoffa, in Lovasco, which I believe Your Honor wrote, the court has held that the police do not have to file charges at the moment they have probable cause. The court has recognized that it's perfectly reasonable for police to go to a man's house, knock on the door, and attempt to question him before they make an arrest. This is perfectly reasonable behavior, and as the court knows, reasonableness is the test under which all Fourth Amendment decisions are rendered. I submit that the conduct here was perfectly reasonable. So I submit that the confession at the precinct...
You have to assume the police officer's version of the arrest rather than the defendant's version in order to reach that conclusion?
Oh, yes, but
were there findings that they told the truth and he was lying when
yes.
they barged into the apartment with the guns drawn?
Yes, there was. When the court rendered its verdict, it expressly discredited the defendant's version. If I can get the cite for that.
It is at page 27, I believe, of the joint appendix.
Page 29 of the joint appendix. I cannot accept the defendant's version with respect to the coercive nature of the statement, or that this statement was other than voluntary or true.
Well, that's not with regard to what the behavior was at the time they entered.
No, but I think that's the court's ruling on the entire testimony of the defendant. The defendant's testimony at trial started with an involuntary entry, gunpoint questioning, so on and so forth, culminating in an involuntary confession in the precinct. And I submit the court specifically.
What did the Court of Appeals say about it?
The Court of Appeals didn't precisely reach that issue. The Court of Appeals applied the Brown factors, which is the next point I'd like to get.
The Court of Appeals said that Peyton applied, didn't it?
Oh, yes, we agree with that now.
And you agree that Peyton applied?
I agree now, yes, I do.
Well, I'm wondering what we're sitting there about.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear you.
I wonder what's up left. Once you agree on Peyton, aren't you in trouble?
Well, no, okay, excuse me. I agree that the police violated Peyton here. However, I do not agree that the precinct confession should be suppressed. I think that Peyton should not apply to a precinct confession. I submit that because there was probable cause, Brown does not apply the way the Court of Appeals applied it. I submit that because there is probable cause and Miranda warnings, that should attenuate the precinct confession. And in any event, I believe that the Court of Appeals misapplied the Brown factors in finding this confession was...
New York ever approved this rule of the police department that you did not need a warrant?
Oh, yes. In People v. Lane, which is cited in my brief, I believe it's 64 New York 2nd.
I only saw one case. Is that the one?
Yeah, Lane. Now, see, in New York, under New York law, one has to file...
This rule is the rule of the police department, not the New York courts.
Well, okay, I don't believe it's...
Well, this opinion says that.
Yeah, that's true. I think that was an unfortunate mistake, frankly. As you notice in my reply brief, I mean, the policy of the department is emphatically to the contrary.
Well, what does the policy of the New York Police Department have on us?
Absolutely
not. Are we bound by it?
Oh, no. But I don't want to leave the court with the impression that the policy is other than it is. I mean, I would not like a factual mistake to color this court's judgment. But with respect to New York law, a search warrant can only be obtained once the police have filed an accusatory instrument. This commences the action. It triggers the New York right to counsel. In Lane, the felony complaint had been signed, but had not been filed. And the Court of Appeals approved an admissible confession there. The action hadn't commenced. So that is the law of the state of New York. Now, back to the Brown standards. For the reasons I've argued, I don't believe that the police conduct here was purposeful or flagrant. In Brown, after all, they broke into the man's house and arrested him at gunpoint as he was coming home. Here, the Peyton violation was of the most minimal nature. It was nothing like Peyton where they broke in the door. This is a knock on the door. We're the police. He says, come on in. I'm glad you came for me. Now, had the hearing court found a consensual entry, which is what we'd argue below, there would have been no Peyton violation at all. The Peyton... Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, there's no consensual entry even if you just walk up to the knock on the door and show your badge.
They said they had a warrant, or misrepresented they had a warrant, if I'm not mistaken. And the court held that where there's a warrant, there can't be consent. If I'm not mistaken, that's Bumpers.
Mm-hmm.
Had the court found its facts a little bit differently, there'd have been no Peyton violation. My point is, the Peyton violation occurred here, or was found here at the hearing, some months after the entry. As Justice Stevens said in the Garrison case, I mean, we have to judge these circumstances as they appeared to the cops at the door. Knock on the door, come on in, I'm glad you came for me. I mean, I submit that on an objective view to any reasonable police officer, that would sound like an invitation to enter. That's certainly the way it appeared to these police officers.
Well, they had their guns drawn.
Their guns were down where the defendant couldn't see him. I would admit that, you know, if they were pointing them at his head, it would be different. But the record is clear that he could not see the guns. And the guns were holstered as soon as they went into the
If they had them unholstered and concealed, they weren't entirely convinced that they would be welcome, were they?
Well, they were prepared. This was, after all, a homicide and investigation. And there were three knives within easy reach, as it appears, once they got into the apartment. But the defendant was completely congenial, and as soon as they saw each other, any coercive atmosphere disappeared. They holstered their guns. They immediately read him the Miranda rights.
That's if you accept the police officer's testimony.
Well, that was the testimony.
As I read over the trial, what the trial court said, he really was concentrating on the second confession, not what went on at the time of the entry.
Well, I submit, though, that in order to find attenuation...
And also, it's also clear that all the courts in the New York system agreed that the entry was not consensual. So I think that means we have to accept at least some degree of credibility to the other side's version of the facts.
Well, okay, but I mean, in terms of the flagrancy of the police conduct here, I think it militates on my side towards that. I mean, this is clearly not, you know, a flagrant violation. It has occurred in Brown.
Well, of course, it depends on what one means by the word flagrant. If there's a deliberate policy to violate the Constitution in order to avoid the effect of a New York rule that would make it improper to interrogate the person, one might say that's flagrant, too,
well,
if that's the case.
There are two answers to that. One is California v. Greenwood, of course, in which the court held that the notions of state law should not control for Fourth Amendment purposes. And also, I mean, the flagrancy, at least as I understand the case, is it has to be flagrant violation of the federal Constitution. I mean, a state rule of law, I submit, probably is not a flagrant violation within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment.
This is not state law we're talking about.
Well,
this is police department of a city's law.
To avoid...
Aren't they different?
Well, yeah, to avoid a New York State constitutional requirement, not a federal constitutional requirement. Patterson v. Illinois.
Mm, it's like, sitting beside Blue Rock.
Police procedure is wrong. Yeah.
I am not trying to condone the police procedure, Your Honor. I'm merely saying that it is not a flagrant disregard of the federal Constitution. This court has recognized...
Flagrant and violations of my Constitution.
Well, the difference has to do with the police officer's
intent.
Well,
what would have made it flagrant? For them to curse him or something?
No, what would have been flagrant would have been what happened
if
in Brown.
If they hit him in the head with a blackjack, would that have been it?
That sure would have been flagrant.
What below that is flagrant?
Below that would be the facts as in Brown, where they break into the man's apartment, wait for him to come home as he walks up to the door, arrest him at gunpoint. That's flagrant. That's clearly flagrant.
It would be flagrant, too, wouldn't it?
Sure would. But, I mean, here...
Well, are we obliged to find what is flagrant in this circumstance? Because the city of New York, I mean, the state of New York, in its opinion, has already said it was a violation. They didn't need to say flagrant or anything else. They said it was a violation.
Well...
Now, why can't we say the same thing?
Well, okay, I do believe... If you are going to apply the Brown attenuation standards, you do have to come to grips with the question of whether or not it's flagrant. As I read the court's opinions, the flagrancy of the police conduct is one of the most important considerations. So I submit the court is going to have to answer that question. I mean, there are violations. For example, take United States v. Leon, where the taint is the good faith reliance on what turns out to be an invalid warrant. There should be no suppression at all. I mean, now there's a violation that's not flagrant. The same may be said of Cruz and Ceccolini and in Michigan v. Tucker, where the Fourth Amendment violation leads to the testimony of a live witness. Again, we have a violation that's not flagrant. I submit the same thing should be said here. Here there is a patent violation, but under the circumstances of the entry and the police behavior and the fact that they can go to a man's apartment and attempt to gain entry to question him, plainly the violation is not flagrant. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Coddington. Mr. Parker, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, on January 16, 1984, three New York City police officers, each with 18 years experience on the force, went to Bernard Harris's home, both to question him and to arrest him in connection with a homicide 5 days earlier. 5 days earlier, on the 11th, the police officers, specifically, Detective Rivers, who was in charge of the investigation, had probable cause to arrest Harris. In addition, they knew on that day, the 11th, where he lived. The officers were apparently not concerned that Harris was a threat to anybody else, nor were they concerned that he might flee, because between the 11th and the 16th, insofar as the record shows, they made no effort at all to apprehend him. Now, the specific purpose in going to Mr. Harris's house was to question him. Both officers testified to that, McCarthy and his partner, Rivers. Both of these were 16-year detectives. The officers did not have a warrant. No effort had been made to obtain a warrant. Furthermore, the record shows, the record does not suggest that the arresting officers, in connection with their efforts to arrest Mr. Harris, went anywhere other than to his house. Now, obviously, police officers in this case are presumed to have knowledge of and be bound by this court's decision in Payton, a decision which, of course, in the first instance, talked directly to New York City Police Department. In addition, there is a memorandum which is not part of the record, but which is quoted in the state's reply brief. That memorandum apparently was circulated to all police force members, and specifically to detectives, at about the time Payton was decided. So I think the record is clear that these officers knew what Payton required. So it was after dark, there were no exigent circumstances at all, and although the arrest took place 4 years after this court's decision, Detective Rivers, the 18-year veteran, testified that it was not the custom in his department to comply with what this court said the Fourth Amendment required in Payton. He was asked by the court if it was the custom in his department to get warrants. Detective Rivers said no. And I suggest to this court that there is nothing in the record which contradicts or qualifies Detective Rivers' admission about the existence and the application of the custom.
Can you tell from the question answer whether he was referring to search warrants or arrest warrants?
The questioning, it was not specific, but in context, they were talking about arrest warrants. I think there's several important things about
Police here would have been no better off with an arrest warrant, would they?
Pardon me?
The police here would have been no better off with an arrest warrant than with probable cause, would they?
They would have been they could have lawfully arrested him at home with an arrest warrant. Simple probable cause would not have done that. I think one of the ironies of this case is that the petitioner could have been arrested anywhere except in his home. The police made no effort to arrest him anywhere except in his home. Now, Rivers' testimony...
But do you think that makes the person arrested somehow more likely to confess than if he were arrested outside his home? Is there something about that fact that enhances the exploitation of that illegality?
Well, I don't think I think they're obviously both potentially coercive events. I think the fact that he was that an arrest in the home is not for Fourth Amendment purposes of any less significance than an arrest on the street. We're not making that argument. But to return to Detective Rivers,
or any more significant.
I'm sorry?
Or any more significant.
That is the point. That is the point of your case, isn't it? Because I take it you would concede, maybe you wouldn't, I take it you would concede if there is an arrest outside and the warrant is somehow defective, that the statement is nevertheless admissible?
I think this court's decisions indicate that that result would obtain, Your Honor.
Well, then it is the fact that he was arrested in violation of Payton in his home that establishes the invalidity that you must rely on here, is it not?
It's our position that the statement given later at the station house must be suppressed as a result of the illegal arrest in the home as a result of the Payton violation.
And why is it that a statement taken at home is deemed to be more coercive than a statement taken someplace else?
Well, Well, I'm not saying that's a per se rule. I think you have to look at all of the facts.
Not saying it's a per se rule that,
I'm sorry,
that a statement taken at home in violation of Peyton is inadmissible?
No, I'm not saying that a statement taken at the home is necessarily more coercive than a statement taken somewhere else. I am saying, of course, that a statement taken at the home or a statement taken as a result of a Peyton violation becomes inadmissible.
Well, suppose there hadn't been any statement taken at in the house at all, but there was an entry without a warrant, without an arrest warrant, and you go to the station house, give them Miranda warnings, and then you get a statement. Would you be here then?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
You would say it's just the fact that there was an illegal entry that's coercive?
Well, I think in those circumstances, the rule that applies is that a confession obtained through custodial interrogation after an illegal arrest should be suppressed unless the state shows sufficient attenuation.
That's the Brown
rule, Your Honor.
Illinois rule.
You needn't focus on the statement taken at the house at all as to whether it might contribute to the coerciveness.
Well, I think that's not in this case. I believe this court granted certiorari only with respect to the station house statement, but there obviously are circumstances where the a statement given earlier might be one of the factors considered under Brown that made the second statement less attenuated, but I don't believe that's something that is presented for this court's decision here.
General, in a brief filed in this case, suggests that we should limit Brown versus Illinois and its rules on attenuation to circumstances of arrests without probable cause.
Okay. Two things about that, Your Honor. First of all, I do not adopt and I do not believe that what this court was concerned about in Brown and Dunaway and Taylor were arrests without probable cause. I believe that in those cases, what the court wrestled with was the notion of how most efficiently to deter an illegal arrest. Arrests can be illegal for a variety of reasons. They can be illegal because there's no probable cause. They can be illegal because there happens to be no warrant. I believe that there is no good policy reason to focus on one type of arrest and exclude another type of arrest that, because of the circumstances, might be more flagrant. What you have in the usual circumstance of no, what it seems to me complicates the cases involving arrests without probable cause is this court's recognition of the difficulties police officers have in making spontaneous or difficult on-the-spot judgments. But here, we don't have that situation. This case, I suggest, is far more flagrant than Dunaway or Brown. I would suggest, creates a substantially more compelling justification for the application of an exclusionary rule than Brown, Taylor, and Dunaway. It was a home arrest. They knew they had to get a warrant. The policy manual told them 5 days, no effort to get the warrant. They could have arrested him anywhere. They intended to arrest him without a warrant. The officers made no effort to look for him anywhere but in the home. And as the New York Court of Appeals found, this series of steps by the police was intended to avoid restrictions on custodial investigation imposed by the New York State Constitution.
Well, why should that interest us, what the New York Constitution imposes on New York State police officers?
Well, I think it... It adds, what it does, simply, Your Honor, is I think it makes more plausible the existence of the custom. It indicates why that custom probably arose and why it is plausible to assume in New York, to assume, as the Court of Appeals did in New York, that the custom was followed.
But you're saying it rules out other possible explanations.
It tends to rule out other possible explanations.
If the reasoning behind Peyton is that the wrong there is the entry of the home without a warrant, why isn't that wrong satisfactorily compensated for or protected against by simply excluding whatever the police might have seen or seized when they came into the home?
It does not do that, Your Honor, because in many instances, what the police officers are likely to be looking for when they go to make a patent to make an arrest is not simply tangible or testimonial. Excuse me, it's not simply a tangible evidence, but they go as they did here to try to get some sort of statement. And the Solicitor General's approach to the problem doesn't address that concern.
But they can get that by arresting him on the street, can't they?
They could have arrested him on the street, no question about that. But they chose to...
If you're trying to figure, as I take it all of us are trying to figure out exactly what happened here and why it happened, it seems to me the most logical explanation for why the police did this at home rather than on the street, if they were trying to pull something off, was to get inside the house and see something. That they could do inside the house, and they couldn't do it on the street. They could talk to the fellow on the street just as they could inside the house.
Well, I cannot really fully reconstruct what the thinking of the police officers was here, but if you look at the kind of information they had when they went to his house and what may have been missing, I think it's what it looks like. They, as we said, had probable cause, but may not have had enough to convict this man. And what they needed was a statement. And maybe after, based on their experience, they thought the best way, the easiest way to get the statement was to confront him at home. I don't know. I'm speculating about that, but the record certainly doesn't definitively answer that. But if you assume that in some instances, for example, in this instance, the police wanted to get a statement, then they would not be deterred from patent violations by the Solicitor General's rule.
May I ask a question in New York practice? As I understand it, if they had gotten the warrant, that would be an accusatory instrument which would have required the appointment of counsel and precluded questioning until the lawyer was appointed. But without getting a warrant, say they just picked up a man on the street on probable cause, would that same prohibition against questioning apply?
They could have arrested him on the street without a warrant. The accusatory instrument would not have had to have been filed.
At what point in the process would it have been necessary as a matter of New York law to file something that would have terminated their ability to go ahead and questioning?
I believe he would have been arrested, he would have been arraigned, and at arraignment, or shortly after arraignment, some kind of information, felony complaint or misdemeanor complaint, would have had to have been filed, and at that point, at arraignment, the right to counsel would have attached.
So that until they either get an arrest warrant or some kind of a formal complaint is filed leading to an arraignment, they could go ahead and question him.
That's correct. I believe that the really principal difference that separates the prosecutors And our position is whether a Brown attenuation analysis really applies in these circumstances. It's our argument that it certainly does, because if the primary rule of the primary thrust of the exclusionary rule is going to be deterrence, stopping not applying it to a situation here where you have an arrest that is has been found to be purposefully flagrant is not going to deter police or eliminate this custom. In view of the court's position on consent, I will not address that. I believe I've covered most of the main points I have. I will, if there are no questions, I will surrender the balance.
Mr. Parker, maybe you can explain to me what I really don't understand. What is attenuated under Brown? If the object of excluding the confession was to exclude something that has been coerced, I could understand that you would look for attenuation of coercive impact. But that's not the object of the exclusion, as I understand it.
I think the object of the exclusion in Brown is to eliminate the incentive to violate the Fourth Amendment. Brown wrestled, in addition to wrestling with the issue of how Miranda warnings fit in there, following Wong Song and the older cases, wrestled with the a notion of where you draw the line following an illegal event in order to bring about deterrence.
So you think the most significant factors are how flagrant was the event, which ought to be sanctioned by the exclusion. And it's sort of strange to refer to that as attenuation.
I'm not sure I could think of a better term. It's a shorthand that we're all familiar with.
Yeah. Doesn't it mean in part letting the defendant get back to normal from whatever effect the wrongful action might have had on him?
It means that in part, I believe, and that's why it looks to the temporal factors. But it's complicated because I believe this Court's opinions have now indicated that insofar as attenuation analysis is concerned, the most important factor is the flagrancy of the police misconduct.
We've said that it's not a Fifth Amendment principle.
It's a
Fourth Amendment principle. So really what we're looking to is not how coerced was the confession. And that's what gives me the difficulty in conceptualizing it as attenuation.
Well, I realize that that there are gray areas around these principles, but I think that in terms of setting doctrine that courts can apply and have now experience with applying and are comfortable with applying, the attenuation analysis seems to be working. There is no indication here in the record here in this case that it's not.
The question is whether, I suppose, in general, whether the statement at the station house was a product of the arrest in the house without a warrant.
Well, I believe under this Court's controlling doctrine, that burden...
Yeah, well, isn't that the issue or not?
Yes, I would agree, yes.
Yeah.
But it...
Are you sure you'd agree? I think that makes it a Fifth Amendment principle. I think when you say a Fourth Amendment
principle... Well, that's a factual question, yeah. Certainly, but...
Well, would you, and if you say it is a product there of the illegal entry, I would suppose it would be the same product if the statement was taken 2 weeks later.
But there may be other intervening factors, and of course they begin to... implicate Fifth Amendment concerns, but here, of course, the police went to Harris's house for the purpose of getting a statement, and they got a statement.
Well, but they got a statement in the house, and they got one at the station house. But the issue is the one is about the one at the station house.
That's correct.
Mr. Parker, can I ask you another question about New York law that I'm just not entirely clear on? This rule about the accusatory instrument makes it impermissible to question the suspect without a lawyer until a lawyer's, and you can't waive that right except in the presence of a lawyer, which, as I understand it, is the holding in your Samuels case in 1980. Was that the law prior to Samuels? Is this old New York rule, or is this kind of a byproduct of Peyton, is what I'm really asking?
No, I believe this body of law existed before Peyton. It went back to some decisions in, I believe, the mid to early 60s.
I see.
And, of course, when Peyton came along, the body of law imposing the restrictions was suddenly confronted with this new element, this requirement that this court set in Peyton. I think what is significant there is that following Peyton, the legislature was asked to reconsider the requirement of accusatory instrument filing as a predicate to an arrest warrant, and the argument was made that some difficulties might be created, some difficulties had been created because of this court's Peyton decision, and the legislature rejected it. So here we have a case where the New York legislature, it's not, of course, the legislative history is not as complete as you would have for congressional action, but there is some indication that the legislature in New York was aware of this position, aware of this situation, and did not change the law, having been advised of these concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Parker, and thank you for serving as an amicus curiae for the court in this case.
Thank you.
Mr. Coddington, you have 8 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have no intention of taking all 8 minutes. I expect to be very brief. If I may, I'd like to begin by answering Justice White's question. I submit that the precinct confession here is by no means the product of the entry at all. I think the Peyton violation here is completely addressed by seizing whatever evidence might have been found in the house. And to extend it farther than that, I think, would be to apply a but-for rule, which this court in Brown said was not the law. So I submit that it is not a product whatsoever of the entry. And I think in terms of attenuation, you can look to the second statement for evidence of attenuation. It was much, much more detailed than the first. The first statement essentially said, I killed her because she was an unfit mother. The second statement, about an hour later, went through the detail of the prior affair with Herbie, the abduction, that she lied to him, so on and so forth. And none of these details were given to the defendant by the police. This all came from his own recollection, his own independent act of free will. That's what I believe attenuates this confession. With respect to the time factor, here it's about an hour. In Rawlings, I believe it was about 45 minutes. So, I mean, there is precedent in this court's opinions for the time factor serving the effects of attenuation. Finally, back to the non-policy, I'll call it, of the New York State Police Department. Remember, in the record, only one police officer testified that it was the custom to not get warrants. McCarthy, at Joint Appendix page 8, said that if the defendant hadn't opened the door, he'd have left. Rivers himself, at page 380 of the record, testified that he'd been there once before. Nobody was home. He left. And why they went to this man's house?
Should we say there's a patent violation, and whether it's a product of a policy or not?
Okay, fine, good. That's the point I'm trying to make, and this goes to the flagrancy of the police conduct, which is what most of the thrust of the amicus argument was. That's what I'm responding to. It is not flagrant. I believe it was. Had the facts been found slightly differently, it would have been in all respects lawful. It was not flagrant. This is, frankly, I think, a clean case. This is a case where a hearing court, with the benefit of hindsight, found the facts differently than they appeared to the police, and that's why we're here. For all of these reasons, Your Honors, I think the Court of Appeals misapplied this court's precedents, and I ask you to reverse their judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Coddington. The case is submitted.